Iran has dismissed a move by the UN Human Rights Council to announce a fact-finding mission on the recent incidents in the country. Nearly 200 Palestinians and international organizations call on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. And Belgian police clash with a group of football fans in Brussels following Morocco's win over Belgium in the Qatar World Cup. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran has dismissed a move by the UN Human Rights Council to announce a fact-finding mission on the recent incidents in the country. The foreign ministry spokesman says Iran will not cooperate with the UN mission. Nasser Kanani says Iran has already formed a national fact-finding committee to look into the events. Kanani also has been warning that some Western countries are using human rights for political objectives. He says that this undermines the legitimacy of the UN mechanism. The anti-Iran resolution by the UN Human Rights Council was proposed by Germany on Monday. The Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the German ambassador to lodge a strong protest over the move. The ministry also slammed as baseless and meddlesome the recent comments by the German officials on the situation in Iran. For more on that, we're joined by John Stepling, author and commentator, who is with us from Norway. If you would please tell us your opinion regarding the fact that European countries, a small number of European countries, by the way, keep meddling in Iran's internal affairs, and now they're suggesting a fact-finding mission to see what happened during the riots. And this is despite the fact that Iran has its own fact-finding mission regarding the matter.
Well, this is a typical scenario for the United States. It's the Libya, Syria, Ukraine scenario, all the color revolutions. The U.S. goes in and creates unrest, hijacks protests. John Bolton, as much as admitted, that the U.S. is covertly arming opposition groups against Iran and so forth. One of the cover story in this particular case is women's rights, human rights, and so forth. And the hypocrisy is pretty obvious. It hardly needs explaining at this point. But, this is – the U.S. doesn't care about women's rights in Saudi Arabia, for example, or the rights of Palestinian women, or, on and on and on. But this is exactly what was done in Libya and Syria. I mean, the United States wanted to get rid of Assad. The United States decided it needed to get rid of Gaddafi, especially because he had proposed a trans-African currency, a gold dinar. These things are unacceptable, and this is what the CIA does. And they have a budget of untold, tens of millions of dollars, and this is the sort of thing they spend it on. So the protests that may have begun as small legitimate protests were very quickly hijacked. We know that one of the actors, Ms. Alinejad, is friends with Mike Pompeo, has had meetings with Mike Pompeo and other U.S. Government officials. So the U.N. taking part in this U.S.-created narrative is unfortunate, but the UN is increasingly unreliable and without credibility. They are increasingly at the bidding of the United States, and you see that with the Ukraine story and the hypocrisy around that. But the ultimate goal of the United States is, in their eyes, regime change in Tehran, the same as the entire Ukraine conflict. The ultimate goal is regime change in Moscow. These are equally delusional ideas, but such is the mindset of the Straussian neocon cabal in Washington. They have very fanciful and extremist ideologies, and they think it's perfectly okay to interfere in the affairs of sovereign nations. And that's what's going on here. And the UN is going along with it and not not questioning the information they get from the United States.
And under such circumstances, how do you see the situation? Do you believe that Iran should be cooperating with such a fact-finding mission?
No, no. I think there's no reason at all for Iran to participate on any level with this, because it only serves to at least partly legitimize the process, and it's an illegitimate project. Iran has nothing to gain. I think they should sever all ties with the United States, I mean diplomatic ties, because I don't see the good that can come out of it at this point. The U.S. has sanctioned Iran. These are criminal sanctions. The United States sanctions almost everybody, but they have illegally sanctioned Iran. Iran agreed to the JCPOA, bent over backwards to meet all its requirements, and the United States tore it up anyway. The U.S. is very big on tearing up treaties and international agreements. Iran has done none of that, and yet they are constantly the object of this rhetorical abuse from the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, European media. It's unbelievably biased, and it's very hard, I think, for the Western public to get an accurate picture of the situation vis-a-vis Iran, because much as it is impossible for Western public to get a picture of Russia, because the reporting is so extraordinarily biased and one-sided.
Thank you very much. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us live from Norway. On the occasion of Basij Week, Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has addressed members of the volunteer force. Basij, which is affiliated to Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, has been at the forefront of confronting rioters in the country. In his speech, the leader said that negotiating with the U.S. will not resolve anything, adding that Iran's main confrontation is with the global hegemony and not a bunch of rioters.
It was an important forum comprised of volunteer forces that have been at the forefront in confronting the rioters. The all-too-important Basij force, which throughout the decades have not only served in the security arena, have contributed to Iran's advancements in a host of fields like science and technology. Iran's leader, in his address to them for the occasion of Basij Week, said that these forces have sacrificed themselves in order to save people from a bunch of rioters and mercenaries. But he also advised them on who the real enemy is, that in the bigger picture, Iran's battle is not with a group of rioters, but with global hegemony. The onslaught on Iran, especially through the media, has been organized by foreign actors, like from Saudi Arabia and the UK, with US and Israel aiding and abetting their fake news. The primary goal has been to create unrest inside of Iran by inviting Iranians to come out and protest. At the same time, there are some under the misguided belief that talking to the U.S. will solve Iran's problems.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
But Iran's leader has said that negotiating will not resolve anything, saying that our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom.
Iran has held several rounds of talks with the West over its civilian nuclear program, but the negotiations have not yielded the results that Iran wants. The main reason has been the U.S.'s excessive demands and its lack of will to compromise. The U.S. wants to strip Iran of all of its capabilities, which includes its nuclear knowledge and defense capabilities like missiles.
There have been lots of speculations as to why the riots began in the first place, especially the timing, which came when the JCPOA sanctions removal talks with world powers were deadlocked over Washington's lack of commitment. It is a distinct possibility that the recent riots may have been part of the West's pressure on Iran to compromise on its rights in negotiations, including with the U.S. Yet the whole notion on continuing with these talks is not in the best interest of Iran, and can never bear fruit due to the West and U.S.'s excessive demands. Realistically, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, to change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside of its borders, and to close its defense industries, basically stripping the country of its identity. Some of these restrictions and excessive demands are due to Israel, which acts in line with U.S. policies to maintain dominance over the region. After all, the U.S. has worked hard to vilify Iran through Iranophobia in the region, pushing Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel to unite against regional power, Iran. That is one of the reasons that Iran has time and again said that the U.S. must leave the West Asia region, as it only seeks to weaken and ultimately disintegrate Muslim countries, as stated by advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati. The U.S. has played a destructive role in the region, like pushing hard for the partitioning of Iraq and Syria, trying to do the same with Iran. This has been a goal of the U.S., a West Asia region whose borders can be redrawn to their liking, with the ultimate goal of having vassal states serving U.S. interests. But when it comes to Iran, that will be an impossible feat. One only has to look at the most recent showing of Iranians when it came to their large-scale presence earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, and for the funeral of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, whom the U.S. assassinated back in 2020 from a drone strike in Baghdad. Not to mention the funeral processions which Iranians participated in, the funerals held in Karaj, Isfahan, and Shiraz.
Nearly 200 Palestinian and international organizations have called on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's acts of aggression against Palestinians. The NGOs say the probe should cover crimes committed by Israel during its war on the Gaza Strip last August. They said the regime has engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity, including the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. They called for appropriate measures to prevent such crimes. The organization also slammed Israel's move to label Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorists and called for public condemnation of such measures. Palestinians have witnessed a sharp increase in Israeli attacks this year. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians this year, almost a quarter of them children. An organization observing human rights situation in Yemen has released shocking figures documenting the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition during its aggression there. The Eye of Humanity Center for Human Rights and Development says more than 18,000 people have been killed in nearly 8 years of war on Yemen. That includes nearly 4,800 children. The center says nearly 600,000 homes have also been destroyed during the war. It adds that universities, schools, mosques, airports, power stations, and factories and medical facilities were completely destroyed during the aggression. Many of those public places were prime targets of the coalition warplanes. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Riyadh has defied international calls to stop the deadly aggressions and blockade. Earlier, we asked our correspondent in Yemen, Youssef Mari, to give us a report and put things in perspective.
This report by Eye of Humanity is very misleading. And the reason why I say that is because this report or these statistics, their compiling of the figures, is only taken into consideration the numbers of casualties as a result of the airstrikes and as a result of the Saudi aerial tens of thousands of innocent Yemenis. According to the BBC, back in 2020, in a story that they published, 85,000 innocent Yemeni children, they died as a result of the blockade. So when you take into consideration all of the casualties as a result of the aerial bombardment, and also add to that the casualties as a result of the Saudi-imposed blockade on food supplies and medical supplies, the total and overall number of death casualties here in Yemen as a result of the war well surpasses over 100,000 innocent Yemenis. And that's when you take into consideration the death casualties from the airstrikes and from the Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen's economy, which is preventing basic medical and food supplies from entering the country. Let's also not forget that thousands of Yemenis have also died due to poor medical supplies, and because they needed to be transported out of the country. However, they could not do so because Saudi Arabia also imposed sanctions on Sana'a International Airport.
Morocco's FIFA World Cup win against Belgium triggers clashes after a Moroccan community bursts into celebrations in the Belgian capital. Dozens of fans smashed out windows, threw fireworks and torched vehicles. About 100 officers used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the rioters. Police say 11 people were arrested. Also in the eastern city of Liga, a gang of 50 people attacked a police station, breaking windows and damaging two police vehicles. Police there also resorted to water cannons. Belgium is home to around 500,000 people of Moroccan descent. Morocco beat Belgium 2-0 in their World Cup face-off. A study shows Brexit has compounded a shortage of doctors in Britain, with an estimated shortfall of 4,000 in major specialty areas from the European Union countries. A study by the Nuffield Trust, an independent health think tank, indicates that the UK relied upon European doctors in several fields of medicine before leaving the bloc. This suggests that the recruitment of European medical staff has slowed down, falling below the projected increase. The survey shows that if the pre-Brexit trend continues, there should have been more than 41,000 doctors from the EU or the European Free Trade Association registered in 2021. This comes as the crisis hit state-funded health service NHS struggles after years of underfinancing last week. The Royal College of Nursing announced that the strike action at the first strike action, that is, in its 106-year working history, and that is because of bad working conditions and chronic staff shortages. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The ASEAN summit has taken place, and the U.S. presented a strategic partnership agreement to those countries. Now, will it be enough to sway those countries into its sphere, or is it going to face a resounding defeat when it comes to Chinese influence and trade? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwi. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, some of the highlights. When it comes to U.S.-ASEAN relations, we will take a look at that. Years of diplomatic freeze, this came from the U.S. side. Well, the former U.S. President Donald Trump's lackluster approach was one of the reasons, many dubious of U.S.'s long-term commitments to that region. So we have to wait and see, later on in the program, how that pans out. Then we have the U.S. initiative, in which it was called by the current U.S. President Joe Biden, the Strategic Partnership. Well, it's called for a free and open Indo-Pacific to counter China. But will it work with that aim in mind? And finally, the U.S. goal is confronting China. We ask ASEAN countries whether that's going to work, or are they going to stiff arm China and live with potential consequences? The stiff competition, RCEP.
The U.S. and Chinese presidents have ended a landmark meeting in Indonesia's Bali. During the meeting, Joe Biden and Xi Jinping reiterated the necessity of handling their relations in a peaceful and proper manner. Biden said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming a conflict. For his part, Xi said that he is looking forward to working with Biden to bring Beijing-Washington ties back on the right track. Before the meeting, Biden traveled to Cambodia to underscore the U.S. partnership with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN countries. One of Biden's primary aims during that trip was to counter China's growing influence in that region. Biden announced the U.S.-ASEAN Comprehensive Strategic Partnership and noted a budget request for $850 million in assistance for Southeast Asia. Biden also pointed to a new U.S.-ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, which is aimed at strengthening the U.S. foothold in that region for further economic integration.
Through our new U.S.-ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, we're going to work together to develop an integrated electric vehicle ecosystem in Southeast Asia, enabling the region to pursue clean energy economic development and ambitious emissions reductions targets.
It is no secret that China and the U.S., as two superpowers, are vying for influence in the region. The two countries are locked in a number of disputes, which includes trade, Taiwan, hegemony over the South China Sea.
Online content on this, as posted by viewers, is varied, but it wants to find out whether there's a U.S. commitment. That's what we found out when it came to the social media posts. This is our first post, for example, where it said, ASEAN is at the heart of my administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Thank you for 45 years of partnership and for all that we can accomplish together. Next one, the U.S. on Saturday upgraded its ties with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, vowing to deliver more aid as President Joe Biden steps up efforts to counter China's growing influence in the regional bloc. Now, we dug a little bit further and looked at this. U.S. doubles down on ASEAN aid to counter China, making his first trip to Southeast Asia as president. Biden said that the two sides will tackle the biggest issues of our time, from global warming to significant threats to the rule-based order, along with threats to the rule of law. Next, this tweet seeking to counter China. Biden and hosts ASEAN leaders had a post within a post in which we found interesting, and it was titled, Seeking to Counter China, Biden hosts ASEAN leaders. Now, this happened back in May 2022. Looking deeper into the post, it said, with the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, and the U.S. not part of the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, of which China is a part of, Washington ceded ground to Beijing in the ASEAN region, especially as far as economics is concerned. Okay, so those were some of the posts there. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Joining us for the first segment of the Q&A is Kim Do-joo. He's a political commentator at the Pangol Institution. Kim Dae-joo, welcome to Economic Divide. We are looking at President Joe Biden, where he's come out saying that the relationship between the U.S. and ASEAN countries is at the heart of the U.S. administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Of course, this comes really after a diplomatic freeze, especially from the U.S., former U.S. President Donald Trump, which didn't have a real warm approach to the region as a whole. Biden now has to step up ties. Do you think that he's going to be able to do that, especially with the intention of trying to counter China's growing influence? Will he be successful?
If the goal is to counter China, I'm sure it is doomed. He will not succeed in that direction. The reason is simple. If you look at the relationship between ASEAN countries and China, for example, and this year, despite this pandemic linking over the two sides and other kinds of challenges, if you look at the trade relationship between the two sides, it still scored double-digit growth in the last 10 months of this year. And it's expected to, the total volume of the two sides could reach as high as $1 trillion this year or early next year. This is a strong signal showing to the world that how close China and ASEAN are. Look, the U.S. has a presence mostly, and unfortunately, is a military presence, military bases in Japan, South Korea, in the Philippines, or Thailand. For the U.S., the purpose is to maintain its dominance in this region as well as around the world. For China, it's really about co-development, win-win cooperation.
Okay, that's thoughts of Kim Dae-joo there. Richard Black joins us now. He's from the Schiller Institute, and he's a U.N. representative. Richard Black, welcome to our program. In terms of countering China, U.S. President Joe Biden has said that he wants to build what he has termed as the U.S.-ASEAN Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, in which he said it's going to be an Indo-Pacific region that's free and open, stable and prosperous, resilient and secure. But China and the regional countries are part of the RCEP. That's a huge trade bloc composed of 15 countries. How can the U.S. compete with that? And what should the regional countries be interested in when it comes to U.S. initiatives?
Well, this is a very good question. Look, China has just built, in conjunction with the government of Laos, Laos's first super high-speed railroad. This is part of a plan for all of Southeast Asia called the Pan-Asian Railroad Network. At the G20 summit in Indonesia, prepared a Chinese-designed high-speed rail line connecting the great cities of Bandung and Jakarta. It's now 90% complete. So if the U.S. wanted to succeed in competing, then it would follow China's policy and do likewise. Or to put it another way, how many kilometers of high-speed rail are there in Laos, and how many in the United States? Well, in Laos, because of China's policy, there are 1,400 kilometers of high-speed rail. How many kilometers in the USA? Zero. So the United States could compete, but they would have to emulate China's policy of build, 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 and transfer advanced technology to the former colonial, the underdeveloped, the looted sector.
It's time now from the Info News section of the program, where we take a look at news from around the world. Well, our first item talks about something that's very important, deemed important by Economic Divide, and that's a multipolar world. Now, there's an effort being put forward on that front where China is saying that it wants to help build a multipolar world. Wang Yi told his Russian colleague or counterpart Sergei Lavrov that Beijing will work with Moscow in order to achieve that. Now, China is ready to work with Russia and also other like-minded countries in order to promote the development of a multipolar world, firmly to support the process of democracy and when it comes to international relations, and to defend the international system that's based on the UN. So that is something, obviously, that's very important when it comes to the, some call it the New World Order, but revised. Next up, another huge layoff from a big conglomerate by the name of Amazon, which I'm sure you heard of. Massive layoffs have been actually executed where it's going to sack thousands of workers. The layoffs reportedly coming, perhaps by the time you watch this program, they're going to be happening. U.S. Giant Amazon may fire up to 10,000 employees. That's the projected number. Now, the news of potential job cuts comes days after Facebook parent Meta and also Twitter each carried out massive layoffs, sending clear signals that the tech sector is preparing for an inevitable recession. Next up, the status of the U.S. credit is under question here when it comes to consumers. You have some retail store credit cards that at this point are now carrying APRs of more than 30%. Now, the rate hikes comes by the Federal Reserve, in which major retail credit cards, you may have heard of some like Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Shell, or ExxonMobil and Wayfair, where they recently bumped up their maximum APRs to more than 30%. Now, what does that mean? Well, this means that high inflation is forcing American consumers to rack up more debt, and that's not good news because obviously they have to pay that amount, the principal amount, plus the interest that is accrued on that. Next up, we go to Australia. The topic we chose was slavery, in which there was a law that is not working. A coalition of rights groups have called on the government to strengthen anti-slavery legislation. Australia's businesses are failing to address forced labor risk. Well, that's an important topic when it comes to their supply chains. Now, this comes 4 years after the introduction of slavery laws, in which two out of three companies is not following that. Those were the topics we picked for our InfoNews section. Please do send us any ideas from your part of the world. We would really appreciate it. Contact information is on your screens.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. To get an understanding of this rivalry between China and the U.S., which the IMF has said risks splintering the global economy, we need to take a look at the trade activity between China, the U.S., and ASEAN countries. Now, back in the year 2020, U.S. goods and service trade with ASEAN totaled $362.2 billion. Exports came in at $111.9 billion, imports $250.3 billion, and the U.S. goods and services trade deficit with ASEAN was $138.4 billion. Now, moving on to the year 2021, the trade volume of the goods between China and ASEAN in this case was $878.2 billion. It reached a year-on-year increase of 28.1%. Among them, China's exports came in at $483.69 billion. That's 26.1% increase year-on-year. And then imports were $394.51 billion, an increase of 30.8%. ASEAN actually became China's largest trading partner, which was for the second consecutive year. Vietnam, Malaysia, and Thailand are China's top three trading partners in ASEAN. Now, by comparison, total trade for the U.S. and ASEAN countries was, well, $362.2 billion, in which China's trade with ASEAN countries was $878.2 billion. Now, if you take a look at this chart here, not chart really, but you can see the difference there, how much more it is. It's almost three times that amount. Now, while the U.S. is trying to build a U.S.-ASEAN strategic partnership, which it describes as a free and open Indo-Pacific, in order to counter China, it's going to have a hard time doing that because of the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which includes 15 East Asian and Pacific nations. It encompasses 30% of the world's GDP. In terms of the trade, comes in at $2.3 trillion among its members. 90% of tariffs on goods, that's eliminated within the bloc. So how can the U.S. even begin to compete with that, let alone try to woo the ASEAN members into joining its partnership agreement? I mean, the figures speak for themselves. Okay, let's have our guests rejoin us and get a breakdown on this. We have Kindo Zhu, political commentator at the Pangol Institution, who rejoins us. Kindo Zhu, welcome back to Economic Divide, U.S. Goals in the South China Sea to confront China or to slow down China as they'd like to, which has not ruled out military confrontation, as I'm sure you're well aware of, things like Taiwan, for example. How can regional countries even entertain the thought of war when it comes to this rivalry between the U.S. and China, especially in their own backyard?
Well, obviously, regional countries are perfectly clear of the U.S. strategy to contain China or to have a new Cold War, and they are not warming up to such an idea because they are not for a divided world or divided region. They are for more integration and more investment and trade, more integration in this region, because that's their priorities.
Richard Black comes in now in order to have his take on this. He's from the Schiller Institute and a UN representative. Richard Black, welcome back. U.S. goals when it comes to China, it is obvious that they not only see China as a rival, they want to contain China, and they want China to be slowed down when it comes to, obviously, things like its economic prowess. At the same time, we're looking at a U.S. that has somewhat of a militaristic tone when it comes to China. Are they going to be able to do that? And then comes the countries. Will the U.S. be able to rally those countries behind it?
Well, again, let's refer to the excellent leaders of the ASEAN. The very courageous leader of Cambodia, Hun Sen, made a very strong statement at the ASEAN this week again. And I'll quote, let's look at what the leaders of Asia themselves are saying. He said, a spirit of togetherness in upholding open and inclusive multilateralism, pragmatism, and mutual respect in addressing the existential and strategic challenges we all face. That's the key, inclusive multilateralism. So what's going on? Let's set this in context. There's a new international monetary and trade system being currently formed based on the idea of transferring advanced energy-intense technology to the global south, the former colonial sector. Russia and China are playing the leading role in this. It involves the SCO, ASEAN, the BRICS. So what we're calling for is a very loud chorus internationally of the non-aligned sector, as it has always been called, a renewed vigor coming from the renowned the non-aligned sector, calling for an end for this global NATO drive for nuclear war. And of course, we feel that Iran could play a very leading role in such an international course. The big issue is whether or not there's going to be a nuclear war triggered by global NATO.
The South China Sea is a major trade route. China is a dominant power there. An estimated $3.4 trillion worth of international shipping trade passes through that area each year. China has gained effective control of the route, which has economic, strategic, and political importance. China and the regional countries are also part of the RCEP, which stands for the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. The RCEP is a free trade agreement among the Asia-Pacific nations. The 15 member countries account for about 30% of the world's population and 30% of global GDP. China is a major player in that economic pact.
The world now is facing unprecedented situation. It's important that in the recovery of together, we are focusing on the collaboration aspect. The theme on the B20 is advancing innovation, inclusion, and collaboration. So I think this is really three areas that's very important where the China can play a role.
U.S. goals in the South China Sea is to ultimately confront, then slow down China, which it has not ruled out military confrontations on issues like Taiwan. China also enjoys the status of a comprehensive strategic partner with ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. In 2021, the trade balance between ASEAN members and China came to $668.9 billion, compared to U.S.'s $364.4 billion. Beijing investments in that region worth $13.5 billion, while the U.S. invested $40 billion there.
When it comes to the ASEAN countries, the US and China are vying for influence. The question is, who is in the lead? We argue that there isn't even a competition, since China has beaten US by far. First, the trade volume between China and the Association of Southeast Asian nations has skyrocketed 85 times over the past three decades. Over the past 30 years, the business communities of China and ASEAN have jointly promoted the China-ASEAN Free Trade Area, participated in the Belt and Road Initiative, and supported the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership negotiations, making important contributions to the continuous development of China-ASEAN economic and trade cooperation. Asian countries have also been working toward financial integration for many years, and a new joint statement made by China, Japan and South Korea, and ASEAN countries deepened the trend. The Chiang Mai Initiative, multilateralization, one of the arrangements that fosters financial integration among Asian countries. It is a multilateral currency swap arrangement between ASEAN plus three members. This addresses short-term liquidity difficulties in the region. It also aims to create a regional foreign exchange reserve in a bid to tackle the imbalance in international payments and short-term liquidity shortage. Participants agreed on a $240 billion fund, among which ASEAN countries will contribute 20%, while Japan and China will each put in 32% and South Korea will contribute the rest. When it comes to the ties between ASEAN countries and Chinese President Xi Jinping, the Chinese president in November 2021 called for a new round of what he called upgrades in the free trade area between China and the ASEAN. And what about the U.S.? History has tainted its relationship with ASEAN and the region as a whole. Let's dial back to the previous U.S. administration led by former U.S. President Donald Trump. During the 35th summit in 2019, it was reported that the United States lost ground in its struggle with China for the hearts and minds of Southeast Asia. It contributed this to the decline in U.S. soft power in the region, which had accelerated. It also laid blame on U.S. withdrawal from Trans-Pacific Partnership, along with former U.S. President Donald Trump's America First policy. The America First policy, which neglects the region's strategic interests while economically punishing and alienating potential supporters, in something the current president, Joe Biden, is striving to correct. So, you see, the U.S. has a lot of catching up to do, and given its confrontational approach to China, which is militaristic in nature, it doesn't look that it will stand a chance to pull countries in this region into its sphere. That does it for this edition of the program.
Don't doubt it, the U.S. is going to push its agenda in the South Asian region, with the number one goal being countering China. This will be void of what the U.S. has called a healthy competition that the U.S. says it is open to. The reason is that the U.S. cannot see itself cede its number one status in the world as a superpower. Will the U.S. prevail, or will China? Well, if you ask ASEAN countries, or Latin American countries, or countries in West Asia, or countries in Africa, they're going to say China. Then what's left? That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Ikobe Tahwe, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at things that human beings do to one another that deprives them of their own rights. So sometimes there are acts and actions that I might do to someone else that will obviously take his right away. Now, from an Islamic perspective, sometimes we call them sins, sometimes we call them, you know, bad deeds. Whatever you want to call them, these acts should not exist in our society if we want to live in a happier, prosperous society. Before, in the previous episodes, we were looking at greed, and we said how greed sometimes destroys societies. Another thing or action that human beings indulge themselves in, and obviously in different stages, that affects other people directly, is thieving, as we call in Arabic, sariqa, taking the wealth and the money of other people, stealing it. Now, stealing is one of these acts that destroys societies, that destroys the foundation and the fabric of communities. Now, sometimes we look at stealing as a sin when a person does it. So, for example, when a person takes the money of other people in a secret way, secretively, and when no one sees them, we say he's a thief, he's stealing, he stole something that does not belong to him. And sometimes that action manifests itself in a bigger scale, where, for example, those who are in power, they steal the wealth of the group, the community, the country. And obviously, there are many examples of that. And sometimes a nation steals from another nation when it comes to their resources. So this also causes us a problem. So thieves who steal the money of other people or the property of other people, these guys, they cause destruction to communities, societies, and countries. So when we're looking at stealing, it's a very big concept. It's not just a sin on a personal scale. Obviously, we said the scale goes bigger and bigger, depends on what we are stealing and from whom we are stealing. So we want to dive into the concept of stealing from an Islamic perspective, so we can see what does Islam say about it. Now, first and foremost, Islam says stealing is haram, forbidden. It doesn't matter in what shape, in what form. And there is absolutely no justification in Islam to stealing. Sometimes you might find cases where there are just justified Islamically to do them. Okay, for example, drinking alcohol is completely forbidden. But in circumstances of extreme circumstance where a person, he either drinks alcohol or dies, then Islam says it becomes allowed. So there are circumstances. When it comes to stealing, there are some circumstances where you have to steal. Let us take a short break and then we come back.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. So we said stealing is one of these concepts that we cannot indulge ourselves in. I cannot give myself the right to go into someone else's house, someone else's bank account, someone else's farm, someone else's country, and take things I cannot take. That is not how it works. So Islam, first and foremost, says stealing is forbidden, haram. You can't indulge in it. Second thing Islam did, Islam posed a penalty. There are retributions needs to be done if someone tries to steal. So, for example, we see in chapter Al-Ma'idah, verse 38 to verse 39, Allah says, وَالسَّارِقُ وَالسَّارِقَةُ فَقْطَعُ أَيْدِيهِمْ. The thieving men and the thieving women cut off their hands. Now, obviously, when we want to dive into the jurisprudence of this ayah, it doesn't mean literally cut off their hands, but, you know, you begin with their fingers or nails and fingers and you make your way out. It's not just what the ayah, you know, you can't take it for the face value. You have to look into the details of it. But Islam says there are retributions and it will result to you losing your hand because with that hand you have taken something that is not yours. And the reason for that is very simple. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says when it comes to stealing and thieves and thieving, he says, أَرْبَعَةٌ لَا تَدْخُلُوا بَيْتَ وَاحْدٌ مِّنْهَا إِلَّا خَرَبْ. Four things. They will not enter a house until this house becomes corrupted and brought down to the ground. وَلَمْ يَعْمُرْ بِالْبَرَكَةِ. And barakah and blessing will not enter this house. What are these four? He says, الْخِيَانَةِ, betrayal, السَّرِقَةِ, and stealing. And then he says, شُرْبُ الْخَمْرِ وَالزِّنَا, drinking alcohol and committing adultery. So السَّرِقَةِ stealing is one of these acts that destroys the community. It destroys the society. It destroys the house where the thief lives in. It becomes a corrupted house. So now, when we look at our current situation in the world, we see that the world we live in, there are so many deprived people around the world who their wealth has been stolen, their resources are being stolen, their oil, minerals, or whatever they have been taken by other organizations, by other countries. And sometimes these people, they give it a beautiful title, a beautiful name, and they steal the wealth of people. So if people were left to their resources, if people were left to their treasures, if people were left to their belongings and to their items and to their rightful, that which is rightfully theirs, then you would see the world in a better place. When there's no one stealing, when there is no one taking the rights of other people, people live happy. And most countries that we see around the world, the people that suffer the most are when the governments decide to take their money and, you know, which is rightful theirs, they don't give them what they require. And what happens is that these people suffer as a consequence. So we have to keep in mind that stealing is a problem that we are facing currently in the world. Inshallah, we will continue in other episodes. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.